Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Bert Weisbord, and I'm here to talk with Andrew Mallet about the science in my new novel, In Velvet. Specifically, we'll discuss how we work to explain and to make credible unseasonal animal behavior and mutations in the young in an isolated corner of Yellowstone Park. Before writing novels, I produced feature films, including Ghost Stories starring Fred Astaire and Raggedy Man starring Sissy Spacek. My first novel, Inside Passage, was published in January 2013. My new novel, In Velvet, was published on May 13th of this year. When I worked with Andy, he was doing graduate work at Harvard, studying viruses and their replication. His ability to communicate complex scientific material in a way that I could understand and then explain was just remarkable. The science in Velvet, the hormonal abnormalities, the viruses and how they worked after they were ingested by an animal, it's only believable because of Andy's patient answers to my endless questions. So, Andy, it's great to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Bert. It's a lot of fun to talk to you today.
Let's start, by telling our listeners about Thermophile. What are they? Where do they live? What makes them so unique?
Yeah, that was one of the really fun parts about working on a book like this. You know, my background is in studying viruses, and I've always been attracted to strange and different things, and thermophiles definitely fit that bill. So thermophiles are a group of bacteria, and as their name suggests, they like hot environments.
I think thermo means heat, and phile means love, so they're heat-loving organisms.
Exactly. So they really like hot environments, and they're part of a larger class of these extremophiles, so bacteria that like very extreme environments. And the extremophiles, they're going to enjoy places that are acid, they're going to enjoy places that are really salty, they're going to enjoy places that are really hot. And the thermophiles that we talk about in the book, they're amazing. These are bacteria that survive in boiling acid. And they develop very specialized capacity to live in these completely inhospitable environments. And, you know, when you go to Yellowstone, where the book is set, or when you go to other hot spring environments, you look down in those pools and it looks like nothing's going on, but it's teeming with all sorts of life. And primarily in the bacterial front, these are going to be the thermophiles that take a center stage in Velvet. You had asked, where are they? And, you know, in the book we talk about them being in hot springs quite a bit, but you can find them in other sorts of places and environments where you have really high temperatures. And another great example are undersea vents. So as you go down underwater, you have these vents that are just spewing super hot water, and sitting right around them at thousands of feet underneath the ocean, you've got thermophilic bacteria.
We'll come back to the viruses in the thermophile, but what are, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of research being done on thermophile. What are some of the other uses?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the amazing things, is that you've got these bacteria that have figured out how to evolve and exploit this unique environment, and the fact that they can survive at such high temperatures has made them quite useful for biotechnology purposes. And perhaps the best known example is an enzyme called TAC, so T-A-Q, and TAC is short for Thermus aquaticus, and this is one of these thermophilic bacteria. And what we've been able to do in the lab is take enzymes from this bacteria that will copy DNA. And it can copy DNA at really high temperatures, which most of the enzymes in our body can't. And what do I mean by high temperatures? So if we think about ourselves, you know, our body temperature is 98.6 Fahrenheit, or, you know, in the lab, that'd be 37 degrees Celsius. Well, these thermophilic bacteria, they're not very happy down at low temperatures. In fact, they much prefer to be anywhere from, let's say, 100 to 250 degrees Fahrenheit. So their enzymes are working at a much, much higher temperature, and we can exploit that in the lab. So TAC was identified and then purified from Thermus aquaticus, and now it's since been evolved in the lab and used in various fashions to allow us to take small bits of DNA and amplify them by copying them using this heat-stable enzyme over and over and over again. So you might start with just a handful of pieces of DNA, and by the time you're done, you've got millions of identical copies, all because we can study these thermophiles and how they're able to function in these extreme environments and then use that for a biotechnological perspective.
And that's what we commonly call DNA fingerprinting, right? I mean, that's what you do, use it forensically, right, the police?
Yeah, so you can, the enzymatic reaction that this is used in is called a polymerase chain reaction. And what makes it so powerful is that every time you copy a piece of DNA, that new copy can now also serve as a template for more copying. So if you start with one, the first round gives you two copies, then the next round gives you four copies, and you've got this exponential growth. So in terms of DNA fingerprinting, you can set it up such that you can go out and you can specifically query the presence or absence of unique sites in an individual, be it a person or a bacteria or an animal or something like that. And it's this capacity to then amplify up the DNA that we want and ask if it's present or absent that allows us to then uniquely identify a sample, a paternity situation, a crime situation, or figure out from a lab setting whether or not you're dealing with virus A versus virus B.
Well, so this is where we started. I knew that there were these thermophile and these hot spring pools in Yellowstone Park, and I posited some experiments going on there. But then we had our first problem, which was, and this is the first question I presented to you, I believe, which is how can we somehow use thermophile to explain unseasonal animal behavior? And do you remember how we began thinking about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we had to overcome in the context of this book is that you're not going to have an animal hanging out in the hot spring. Certainly, we all like to go in the hot tub, and there are even hot springs that we can go swimming in, but the ones in Yellowstone, they're boiling. So how could you get something that was happening in that contained environment into an animal that's not going to be swimming around in it or drinking from it? And part of that was just the experimental setup that was happening in the book where this hot spring now was erupting in a way that it wasn't normally doing. And it was spreading the thermophilic bacteria to new places and new settings. And that's where we, in the book, created this kind of intersection between animals and the thermophiles and at least had that first point of contact that could start to set up the chain that then forward that got forwarded throughout the book.
Well, and let me digress for a moment because I remember you helping invent this chemical, what do we call it, ENT, that was superheating the hot spring. So we were bringing these thermophile to incredibly high temperatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that was the premise, was that we were kind of pushing them over the edge in a way that they wouldn't normally see. And normally happen. And I think what would happen in a situation like that is, you know, they would probably just die. But being dead is not an interesting plot device or not an interesting outcome for us. So we had to come up with a way in which this is actually going to make them achieve a unique state that could help explain why we were observing all these changes.
Well, I'm not going to give away the end of the book by explaining what exactly the experiments were and what happened when you superheated. But I do want to go back. I mean, I will say that we solved this first problem by causing the hot spring to erupt and then go into the water supply that the animals were drinking from. I mean, that's what happens, you know, little gullies going mm-hmm. down to creeks, going down to rivers. And so the animals were ingesting them in their drinking water. But then something had to happen once ingested. And now I think is a good time to talk about the viruses. And this is almost entirely your construct, this idea that there are this thermophile were hosting viruses. And what? Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you take us through that?
Sure. I mean, one of the... I mean, you basically have this remarkable situation where you've got these bacteria living in these extreme environments. And you say to yourself, how are these bacteria doing? And then if you look closer, it's not only just that the bacteria are there, but now you have viruses that are parasitizing these bacteria in this crazy extreme environment. And there have been many groups that have looked at this and identified the viruses to begin with. And I think that was kind of an initial question at the beginning. Is it possible for a virus to exist and survive in this setting? And that answer is a resounding yes. There's a remarkable diversity of viruses that infect these thermophilic bacteria. And then the next question was, well, since they're in these extreme environments, maybe these viruses are very different. You know, maybe they're going to look like something we've never seen before. And the answer to that was no. They actually look a lot like viruses from other situations, too. They just have a whole bunch of tiny little tweaks that, in summation, allow them to survive in these extreme environments. So, I mean, in a really simplistic setting, we've got an environment that, even though it's boiling water, is very much like what happens in a pond or what's happening in the sewage treatment plant. You have all of these viruses invading bacteria, replicating, destroying the bacteria that they're in, coming out and going on to find a new host.
So how did you think about what might happen to these particular viruses when the thermophile were superheated and then ingested by an animal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. We kind of, the genesis of this idea, the seed for it, was what happens with normal bacteria and their infection by their virus is called bacteriophage. And in that setting, you can have a virus infect a bacteria, and instead of killing it, it can go dormant. And it'll become part of the bacterial genome and just come along for the ride, not doing much of anything. But then under particular stress responses, that virus can recognize that the host is under stress, and the virus is like, I got to get out of here. Time for me to replicate, make new progeny, and get out before my host dies. And we use this concept of, you know, stress-induced activation to make new progeny as the idea for what's happening in the thermophiles in the book, where they might have viral copies that are latent, but as soon as they're, you know, being exposed to the stress of really, really high temperatures, and as soon as the hot spring is doing its eruptions, that then sends a signal to the virus that it's time to replicate and get out. And that's what happens in this setting.
And where do they go and why? Once ingested by an animal. Say an elk.
Yeah, so in the context of the book, we needed to explain what was happening. You know, there were these unusual changes in hormonal behavior, unusual seasonal events of these animals. And we said, okay, well, how can we get to the experiments that are happening in the hot spring and these changes to the thermophiles and the viruses they're making all the way to changes in animal behavior? And again, this kind of had its basis on known situations where pathogens or parasites can modulate the behavior of their hosts. So we wanted to use that to explain what was happening in the book. So for these animals that are ingesting the viruses, they were getting an infection. And one of the main centers of your body that regulates hormonal balances is the hypothalamus. And we said, well, why wouldn't
you know, it would be an easy way to explain this if these viruses were going into the animals and infecting them, changing their hormones, and that was the cause of this unseasonal behavior.
The to explain in more simple terms, it's the timing of the hormone production and the amount of the hormone production. The timing of the hormone production, altering that, would cause unseasonal behavior, and the amount of the hormone production would cause mutations in the young. And so once in the hypothalamus, and let's digress to explain why they chose the hypothalamus as opposed to some other, I mean, this idea of an immune-privileged environment.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the advantages of infecting brain tissue is that it's very hard for our immune system to surveil and counteract infections there. And it's this so-called immune-privileged site. And that can make it just much more challenging to ever rid yourself of an infection in that setting. And then this also happens to be a major control center linked to the nervous system, to the endocrine system, and the pituitary gland. And these are going to be the regions of the brain that are controlling the hormone production and release. And that's in the concept of what we were observing in the book and how we wanted to frame this. That is what we think these viruses were doing.
And presumably, in an immune-privileged site, the viruses are safer than in one that can more actively defend itself. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's certainly the case. That if you can find a site in the body where the immune system isn't able to recognize you, or even if it can recognize you as a virus, isn't able to affect the strong immune response, that's going to be advantageous for you as a virus. Not so advantageous for us as people being infected.
So once in the hypothalamus of our illustrative elk, what do these viruses do? Do they keep replicating?
They certainly could. Assuming that, you know, in the story we've created, those viruses could certainly replicate, or they could sit there in a non-replicative state but still modulating gene expression by the host. And for naturally occurring viruses that are infecting people, both of those outcomes occur. If you have replication in a host, if you're in a protected environment like the brain, that replication is often going to be very damaging, if not deadly, to the infected cell. And that could explain why you have dysregulation of the hypothalamus function in these elk. Alternatively, if the virus isn't replicating, but it's just sitting there and modulating the gene expression of the hypothalamus, that could also explain how you're getting these different changes.
So, end of the day, it takes quite a while in the book to put this together, but it's a very logical series of steps. And the only way to stop it is to stop the hot spring from erupting and stop the animals from ingesting these superheated thermophile who are hosting these viruses in the drinking water. But before we get there, we ask the question, and this was a dramatic question. This is more of a writer's question, but it had to be answered within a believable scientific context. Could these problems spread to wildlife outside the drainage?
Yeah, I mean, that was a really important question to ask, and there are ways in which we could posit this idea and ways in which it could spread. And, you know, viruses are going to spread in a couple different ways, all of which were possibilities we had to consider. Viruses can often spread from the mother to the young, and that was something that might have been happening in the book with the elk, because we were seeing the malformation of the new elk that were being born. You can also then have spread from adult to adult, so just simply contact that can go from one animal to the next. And then you could have spread from an infected animal through some intermediary. So maybe you're actually getting in contact with infected species or drinking the same water or something like that. And that's all well and good until you consider the fact that these animals aren't just sitting there. You know, these animals are moving about, too. And for elk, which travel large distances and might even migrate over large areas, that was in the context of the book, it was a very serious concern that you might have this rapid expansion of these infected animals going out and spreading well beyond just the drainage ditch of the original hot spring into all of these other situations, and whether or not these things would be confined just to the elk or whether it can move to other animals as well. You know, that was the real concern, I think, of many of the biologists in the book. This was something going to be much bigger than what we were seeing at the time.
Yeah, and I think that that is what escalated the tension, was the possibility. I mean, and, you know, one of the things, and I digress here, but part of the fun of writing the book was to have this come out with locals talking who don't really understand the science. But, you know, mm-hmm. they, you know, Gummer at one point worries about mutated baby elk all over the Rocky Mountain West.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to make that at least remotely possible, and I think you succeeded in that. But let's focus on sort of what it was like for you to work without the constraints or some of the constraints of, you know, scientific research. I mean, to be able to work in a fictional setting where you need to make credible certain plot situations, but you don't need to have scientific data to mm-hmm. prove what you're doing.
Yeah, it was a really fun experience to have that freedom. You know, in a lab setting, you know, we really are confined by the questions we're asking, the experiments we can do, and the data that we get back. And they have to be rigorously tested and retested and shown in multiple ways. And even at the end of the day, we never technically prove anything. We just get an abundance of data that are supporting our viewpoint. In the book setting, we could take these same ideas and same logic and just apply them in ways that were new and different and unexpected. So it offered a lot of creativity that allowed us to hang our hat, as it were, on real and known events that happened in biology and extend them into our environment to see what happens when they are basically set loose. And that was a lot of fun because we weren't now held back in the way that we are in a lab setting. We were creating our own logic and rules that we could follow it forward to an end point.
And what about working within the constraints of a novel? That is to say, you know, I would say to you that, well, we really need to have the possibility of this spreading all over the Rocky Mountain West. Or, you know, mm-hmm. there would be certain plot demands that you had to back up with science, and that's a different mm-hmm. kind of process than scientific research.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we wanted to, within the world that you've created, we needed to stay within that logic to make it consistent and to make it believable, even in the context of a fictional setting. And that was kind of a fun challenge. You know, you said for reasons of our story development, this has to happen. So how can we make it happen? And we'd go back and forth, say, well, we know this happens and this happens and this happens. So could we posit that we might get movement throughout the Rockies because of migration of elk, because of the known routes of transmission for various other pathogens? And when we put that all together, that's how you get that line of reasoning in a book. that also has been consistent with the action that's happening in the book and the concerns and motivations of the different characters.
I'm going to come at this slightly differently from a writer's point of view, because as a writer, you have a challenge of explaining the science without slowing down the story. So that, you know, however clearly you are able to explain it, I have to make it simpler still, because I can't just stop the book for, you know, a lecture for Rachel to simply, you know. And part of what was so much fun working with you was you were very helpful with that. And so that, like, let's talk about Jesse and Gummer, and they are interested in the elk with oversized antlers because they're interested in the aphrodisiac qualities of properties of velvet antlers that were, at the time the book is set in 1995, you know, if you could process them, they were worth $200 a pound. And, you know, some of these elk had 50-pound racks. Well, that's $10,000 a rack. That suddenly becomes a lot of money. And they were trying to start this elk farm where they figured, you know, they'd have a couple hundred at, you know, $10,000 a rack. Suddenly you're talking about $2 million. And so I had to say, to use that situation, and that's the situation where we talk about DNA and what it is and what it does. Do you remember those conversations?
And so it's always fun to explain. It's fun and challenging to take the kind of nitty-gritty and nuts and bolts that we deal with on a regular basis and have spent years studying and bring it up to a larger audience. In a way that makes sense, but still at its core holds true to the biology.
So Jesse can explain to Gummer that, you know, he has Gummer steal Dr. Moody's notebooks, and Dr. Moody is the original scientist who was experimenting at the hot spring, and he was trying to create new kinds of DNA. And and so Jesse says to Gummer, you know, DNA can determines everything. And he talks to him about Jurassic Park and how they use the old DNA to make dinosaurs. And let's spend a minute talking about, and that was a really fun way to let people know, you know, in a way that was not necessarily scientifically detailed, but certainly not inaccurate, that what the science was. And DNA is something that is easier for people to understand because it's more part of the culture than some of the stuff about bacteria and viruses. But let's talk about how you create new kinds of DNA and how what kind of experiments he might have been doing at the hot spring.
Yeah, I mean, so certainly, I mean, the premise from all of this, and I think the way, if I remember, it was Rachel who was doing the explaining, was that all of our genes are made of DNA. And it's this DNA that serves as kind of a permanent copy of what our gene is and what its functionality is going to be. And that DNA then is copied over into another molecule called RNA. And that RNA is a messenger. It serves as a messenger to finally make the functional endpoint, which is a protein. And you can manipulate DNA in the lab, and when you do that, it'll make a different RNA, and that different RNA will make a different protein. And at this point in time, in a lab setting, we can pretty much make designer DNA. And it really is almost as simple as getting on the phone and calling a company and saying, this is exactly the gene I want. And depending on how much you're willing to pay, that you'll get it. So at the hot springs in 1995, they weren't quite at this position. They were certainly in an area where they could identify the DNA, figure out its exact sequence. And what I mean by that is that DNA is actually a long string of individual building blocks that are stitched together. And it's the pattern of these building blocks that dictates the information that's encoded there. So they could go ahead and find this piece of DNA, figure out the pattern of those building blocks and then use this idea that we were talking about before, where you use enzymes from the hot springs to copy DNA and make many, many, many copies of it. So you could certainly do that, finding regions that you think are important for the capacity to replicate in a hot spring, and then make many, many copies and use it for your own purposes, either in a lab setting or whatever it might be. And I think that's the concept of what they were trying to do here, was to find the DNA and then to figure out the genes that it encodes for, and then exactly what those genes could be used. You know, how could they help in understanding how the viruses or the bacteria themselves are growing in the hot springs, but then also maybe how could it help in other situations where you're trying to grow an elk rack that's going to be gigantic and so on?
You know, I'm seeing, you know, when we start talking about this, I could really go on and on. It's so fascinating, but I'm seeing that we should wrap it up here.
Okay.
This has been very helpful, very interesting. I want to thank you for what was just a terrific job working on this book. And if people have further questions, you know, they can just go to my website, www.BertWeisbord.com, that's WEISSBOURD.com, and email me, and I'll get them to you, Andy. And they can also go to my website to find out more about these books and books that are coming up. I'd also like to thank Rare Bird Books, who published In Velvet and the book that came before, Inside Passage, and will be publishing Teaser, which is the sequel to Inside Passage, which is coming out January the 19th. And they really do a terrific job. So thank you all. I hope you will come back, Andy, and we can do this again. And I look forward to people reading the book and their reactions.
Sounds great. Well, thank you very much. This has been a lot of fun.
Okay. Thanks, Andy. Bye-bye.
Bye.